KALW.
There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 wines for sure I cannot do, and the jury's still out on 1 or 2. I've actually been at the edge of tears all week.
Recent wildfires have made grapes in wine country unfit for consumption.
It's an acrid kind of a taste. Not really acidic, but sort of sharp. And it kind of burns your throat a little bit.
Today we'll hear from winemakers in Sonoma. Then we talk to the managing editor of the Oakland side about voter engagement in the town.
Voter participation, it really mirrors these sort of like same old dividing lines in Oakland along income, education level, and race.
And a longtime Oakland poet discusses the theme of spirituality in her first book.
Everything is connected. People say it, but they don't, I believe, really see it.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. August through October is peak harvest season in California's wine country, but this year the region has dealt with one of the biggest wildfires the state has ever recorded. In this story from our partners at Capital Public Radio, reporter Scott Rodd takes us to Sonoma County to find out how winemakers are faring.
Hey.
Hi.
Come on in. This is the tasting room.
Carol Shelton has been making wine for over 40 years. In the back room of her winery, there's an experiment happening. Below oak barrels stacked to the ceiling are plastic buckets filled with crushed grapes from this year's harvest.
These are each one different samples, and we've fermented it. If you lean over, you can smell it.
She's looking for any hint of smoke, and not the kind you might find in a glass of Pinot Noir.
It's an acrid kind of a taste. Not really acidic, but sort of sharp. And it kind of burns your throat a little bit.
These days, wine country in Northern California is essentially wildfire country. Sonoma and Napa counties saw major fires this year at the peak of harvest in August and September. In past years, they occurred later in the fall. A number of vineyards have been overrun by flames. The ones left untouched are struggling with widespread smoke and rising temperatures that threaten grapes. In the short term, that means a messy, uncertain 2020 vintage, from seed to shelf. In the long term, climate change could alter wine varieties in this region and even reshape its borders. Shelton is no stranger to wildfires. The 2017 Tubbs Fire destroyed her old neighborhood.
There were 180-ish homes there, and 178 burned to the ground. Everything that we owned was lost.
3 years later, the smoke and fire have returned to haunt her business.
There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 wines for sure I cannot do, and the jury's still out on 1 or 2. I've actually been at the edge of tears all week.
It's putting a pinch on growers, too. Some winemakers are refusing to buy grapes if they're not tested by a special laboratory, and some insurance companies won't pay claims for ruined crops without those results. Anita Oberholster studies winemaking at UC Davis.
The labs are overrun. I mean, you have waiting times of 30 days, and people are supposed to make picking decisions next week.
On the outskirts of Santa Rosa, half a dozen farm workers fill plastic tubs with freshly cut grapes.
So we've got Rubola Gialla, Tokaj Frulliano, the Greco di Tufa, Fiano, and a little bit of Pinot Gris, all squeezed into 5 acres.
Chris Boland is with Atlas Vineyard Management, which oversees more than 100 California vineyards. He says hotter temperatures resulted in a smaller grape harvest this year.
The heat, it just sucks the water right out of them. So yeah, we're seeing yield losses of 15-20%.
And the impact trickles down to farm workers paid by the weight of a workday's harvest. Lighter grapes mean a lighter paycheck. Still, Boland remains optimistic.
I mean, it's easy to get focused on the negative part of it, but some of the wines that have come off some of the first things we picked are spectacular.
Experts say the long-term outlook isn't so rosy.
Vineyards are going to be dealing with these changes for decades to come.
Lee Hanna is a senior scientist at Conservation International.
Some of the changes may be very, very difficult to cope with if we don't get something done about climate change.
He says vineyards will likely have to switch to grapes that are more resilient to heat, and warmer weather in California will push grape growing further north or to higher elevations. Back in Sonoma County, Carol Shelton is planning to build a new winery just outside Santa Rosa, knowing all too well the risks posed by climate change.
I'm so tired of these fires, I just want to leave California. But I can't.
She remains adamant. Sonoma Wine Country is here to stay, even if the region's shape shifts below her feet. In Sonoma County, I'm Scott Rodd.
Scott is a reporter with our partners at Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. In these final weeks before the election, we're checking in with five locations in the Bay Area with the lowest voter turnout rates: Richmond, East Palo Alto, Bayview, Fairfield, and West Oakland. And Oakland is where we'll go today. Oakland is voting on everything from city council members to the school board, from whether to give the police commission more independence to removing a limit on fines around things like illegal dumping. The team of journalists at the Oakland side have been talking to voters. Managing editor Jacob Seamus says some Oakland neighborhoods may have historically low turnout rates, but that may be changing this year. I talked to him and first asked about the voters they talked to. How informed were they about the issues on the ballot?
What we discovered, I think it's fair to say, is that people are very informed on the issues, in the sense that they're the experts of their own lived experience, right? So if you're living in D3, you know, 3, or you're living in Deep East Oakland in District 7, you know what the issues are, right? I think the other part of the question is, you know, will people come out to vote? We know that, you know, unfortunately, historically, that these districts have had lower voter turnout.
Right. What are some of the reasons for that? I think you looked into what voting has looked like historically across Oakland.
You know, voter participation, it really mirrors the sort of like same old dividing lines in Oakland along income, education level, and race, too. We know that, you know, folks of color primarily are living, you know, in the flatland neighborhoods, and white, you know, residents living in the hills. So, you know, very much mirrors that same divide. Now, why that is a really good question. And I wish I had all the answers, but I think that, you know, when you have communities that have really been excluded from the political process, or who feel like the system is not working for them, I think that results over many years, that results in apathy, right? That's probably understandable.
And people just not trusting the whole system.
People not trusting the system, for sure.
Right. I've heard it many times. My vote doesn't count. This all doesn't matter. It's all a rigged system anyway.
We also have spoken to civic organizations in Oakland that this year have been doing groundwork to get out the vote in those districts.
What are they working towards? Are they working towards voter registration? What's their goal?
Yeah, I think it is. It's voter registration. It's awareness, you know, voter education. It's messaging and just letting folks that their vote counts. I think literally, actually, the League of Women Voters Oakland, which is one of the biggest organizations that's been doing, you know, voter registration and like education in Oakland for years, their approach, like during the pandemic, was to actually hit the streets, partner up with community organizations focusing on Deep East Oakland. And they went out and they walked precincts and they hung door hangers on people's homes with a message that, you know, literally your vote counts. And so I think with information, of course, of, you know, how to vote and how to register and so forth. So I think it's a combination of all those things. And, you know, when I spoke to the League and some of the organizations that they were partnered with, what I heard was that there's actually a great deal of enthusiasm this year, that people in the communities seemed very excited to be talking about issues, and that at least the organizers I spoke to seemed like incredibly hopeful that the turnout this year is going to be higher than it has been in past years.
And I mean, we are seeing that across the country right now with record numbers of mail-in votes so far.
Right.
What are you hearing from these organizers as to why that may be? Why are people this time? And right, we haven't even talked about COVID,
right,
which is another challenge here. But what are they saying in terms of why people are coming to vote this time, or what the urgency is this time, or like why they're excited?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think the sense is, you know, it's the combination of a national election that people are invested in. And it's also, I think here in Oakland, you know, it's just a huge election year at the local level for things like education. And again, you know, council races, and even ballot measures that don't, you know, don't get a lot of hype, but there are some huge ballot measures, you know, locally in Oakland this year that could fundamentally change, you know, schools through like a massive $735 million schools bond for OUSD, and for measures that would do things like increase the power of the police commission, which is the volunteer like citizen organization that you know, oversees the, you know, OPD. It would get
homelessness, encampment management.
Yeah, so a lot of just a lot of big issues on the ballot this year locally, and maybe it's just sort of a zeitgeist of, you know, national issues and local issues coming together.
Have you looked at how COVID has impacted or changed these efforts to register and mobilize voters?
Yeah, I have actually. And a lot of the organizations that typically have really strong ground games in Oakland that are, you know, organizing in-person events and, you know, doing the door knocking and that sort of thing have really shifted to virtual events and virtual organizing. And what's interesting, again, I'll just sort of reference the League of Women Voters, but what they told me, surprisingly to me, was that their attendance at their election events has been greater this year during the pandemic than it was in previous years when they did these things in person. And so, yeah, super interesting. And so maybe there's something about that too, where in a strange way, folks are having to get innovative about, you know, sort of where they convene community and how. And maybe it's in some ways made it easier for some folks to participate. Understanding that that's not going to be true for a lot of, you know, members of the community. But it's interesting that they said that.
Jacob Seamus is managing editor at the Oakland Side. Find their coverage and all our Oakland coverage at KALW.org. Thanks to Victor Tenz for his help producing that interview. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. We're going to stay in Oakland for our next story. Actually, writer Tarita Mikkel has many stories to tell. She's an award-winning poet and educator. Back in the day, she spent part of her nursing career working at the Black Panther Party's health clinic in Oakland, and now she's a published author. Her first book is Synchronicity, The Oracle of Sun Medicine. It's a collection of poetry that covers spirituality and Black culture, while also challenging organized religion and institutionalized racism. KALW's Janae Darden spoke with Tarita about her spirituality and her poetry.
So what is a story medicine woman?
I believe a story medicine woman, in the way I have seen this and the way African professionals have heard me speak, is a woman who speaks things that help heal community. It is like a griot. It is like a storyteller. But for me, because of my background being in the medical field, I tend to add more circumference or circular thinking into my work. And that allows for me to see myself as a medicine woman, because it's all about the circle.
And explain that. What do you mean about the circle?
Well, not thinking so linearly as we do in English, but more connectively. Everything is connected. People say it, but they don't, I believe, really see it.
You know, you talk about healing. How and when did you find healing, the healing power of writing?
I guess that was out of experience. As I've said before, I was a nurse. My first experience was feeling someone's medication on my body and going to their chart and looking at the fact that I was actually feeling that natty web is what it felt like on my body. Mm-hmm. This person wasn't even, it just happened. I walk into his room and bam, the energy hits me. I began just documenting. I've been documenting a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you begin to see a number of other things take place.
And I know you were a nurse for the Black Panther Party. And I think people don't realize that there was so, when it comes to different movements, like the Black Panther Party, Civil Rights Movement, so many people had different roles. What made you become part of the Black Panther Party and bring your medical skills to the movement?
Right. I think a lot had to do with what I was witnessing as a nurse, and then also feeling that, you know, my mindset was about prevention. I wouldn't want to see anyone lose their mother like I lost mine. I know I heard years later as a young adult that my, you know, the doctor hadn't come for a long, long time to even check on my mother. And, you know, my father was from the South. They were both coming up from Arkansas, just moving away from what they thought was maltreatment, mistreatment. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing for me to get into nursing with the Black Panthers.
Was there a clinic?
Yes, the clinic was on Martin Luther King. It's like right on the edge of Berkeley.
Was it like health education and also treating people too?
Yes. Health education, treating people to everything from high blood pressure, diabetes, prenatal care, sickle cell. We did a lot of sickle cell testing.
What was that like for you to service the community in that capacity?
It felt like something was getting done, a number of things. It was, but you felt empowered that you were doing something for your community.
And I wanted to ask you about your spirituality. I think we're seeing a shift in African-Americans when it comes to spirituality, as far as people now exploring more West African spiritual practices and other Eastern practices. People are challenging the church because of issues of homophobia, sexism. Your book, Synchronicity, The Oracle of Sun Medicine, and everything we've talked about comes up in this book. Why this title?
As I said, everything is connected. And for me, there's a connection to everything that will forewarn or tell of the next thing coming, which is synchronistic in and of itself. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, you know, you could be writing something, the radio was on, and just as you're writing, that same word is being said as you're writing. Or, you know, someone is saying something or doing something that you were just thinking about, or someone is relaying a story to you that you just spoke of. You know, all these are synchronicities that the environment is telling you to pay attention to.
In your book, you use humor and language. You know, like the poem about the three little bears. And I will never look at the three little bears the same.
This is the BWYB News. Be watching your back. The Goldilocks cover up. This just in tonight, Goldilocks breaks in three bears' home. Three Bears charged Goldilocks, a.k.a. the Golden Bandit, with illegal entry among several other crimes implicated early Tuesday morning. Witnesses say the intrusion took place just after the family left for a walk in the woods. It was stated when Golden Bandit knocked on the door and no one answered, she let herself in.
What were your ideas of like fairy tales growing up? Did you kind of break that apart? Like, that don't seem right that that little girl broke into the house and ate their food and slept in their beds and tore up their house.
Well, the what initiated that is being a poet teacher in East Oakland. East Oakland poet yes. teacher. You know, I'm out there, you know, near the Hunnets. And all babies. These beautiful brown little babies coming up to me, sometimes wanting to, you know, have me read Goldilocks. And, you know, I looked at the story and as I heard it, I said, you know, can your sister or brother or mama or daddy do what Goldilocks did and get away with it? No, because my brother, he in jail, he broke in somebody. No, that's right. See, you understand. And so it becomes an understanding where, you know, something needs to be written about this. And because of my background as an investigative news reporter, why not? Why not make it a news report, right? So that's what I did.
Last question. What do you hope people get out of this book? Because it's deep.
A healing and a freeing up of the self, a relief.
That was author Tarita McKell speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. Tarita's book is called Synchronicity, the Oracle of Sun Medicine. You can find more information about it at KALW.org. That's also where you can subscribe to the Cross Currents newsletter. The Cross Currents team includes Annalise Finney, Andrew J.M. Garcia, Lisa Morehouse, Sonia Narung, and Marissa Ortega Welch. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shireen Adil. Managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.